It is not who you are, but what you are. That's not an uncommon phrase to hear, but it's not who you are, but what you are. Most people go through life basing themselves on who they are, what their background is, what nationality they come from, what parentage they have, and how they've been brought up, and what sort of class they have, what sort of culture they have, what sort of ethics and mannerisms and attitudes they have. Now the attitudes, there I stop. It's not who you are, but what you are. Because who you are, you can take one whole family. They're all made up of who you are. All have the same mother and father, same grandparents, the same gene structure back up the line, maybe a slight modification here and there, but basically they all have the same. Now, out of these 5 or 10 children, or 2 children, however many may come out of this marriage, each child is different. Even exact twins, what do they say, not look-alike twins, but exact twins, they are different. They try to say that twins are very sensitive to one another when they're perfect twins, but that's not the case. That's not the case because they don't feel everything. They feel certain major hurts that the other feels, but if they're not in tune, they don't feel it at all. And they're not always in tune. They don't always know exactly what the other is doing because they're not always in tune. And why are they not always in tune? Because they're living their own life. They're having their own experiences. If they were always in tune, then they would be attached to each other, mentally, physically, and spiritually. And they're not. They go their own way. Oh, they keep track, like May and Marie, they keep track of each other and they're aware of each other. And like you and your sister, you're, what do you call them?
Identical.
Thank you. You're identical twins. And as identical twins, you are supposed to be identical. You're supposed to be identical in your emotions and your feelings and your heart and your love and your attitude and your body. And you're not. Because your sister is a unique, delightful being in her own. And though you look alike, if the two of you were to be acting, I don't mean pretending, if the two of you were to be expressing yourself in a room, in a dark room, for instance, and no one knows that it's you, that they would think that it could be most anyone. Because you're going to respond just a little differently to situations. For instance, the room is dark, and you're both in the room, and the lights go out, and you can't see a thing. And both of you have never been in that room before, never been in that house before. You don't know where things are. So Rita, who is the intellectual quizzy one, she says, "Oh, just a minute, I know what to do." And so she feels her way around the wall, and she finds a way out the door, and she finds her way down the hall or someplace, and she knows just where she thinks the electrical box should be. And when she gets the electrical box, then she tries to make it go. Now, you, on the other hand, are standing in the room and thinking to yourself, I wonder how I will turn the lights back on. And then you think, well, I would think the most sensible thing to do first would be to try the switch. And so you flick the switch on, the lights go on. Now, why didn't your sister first think of the switch before she thought of the power box? Now, I could have said, you tried the switch, and you tried the light bulbs, and you tried the switch on the lamps, and your sister went out and tried the fuse box, you know, and the fuse box worked, because that was where the problem was. I could say that, and it could be either way, whoever was successful. But it's just minor, but it's a large thing. It's a large thing of the way that you have of looking at things. And even though you're identical, you look at things somewhat differently. So, It's not who you are, but it's what you are. Now, what are you? Are you a person that is manipulated and controlled by your environment? Or are you a person that is manipulated and controlled by your world? I was amazed at my cousin. We were talking at the retreats here, and I was showing it to him and explaining to him how the retreats work and so forth. And he says, "Well, Herbie, tell me, how did it work in that school of the master program? What sort of things went on there?" And I explained the whole thing to him. He said, "Yeah, that's a pretty tough program. That's pretty heavy." He said, "But we've done that in some of our church activities and some of our church programs too, in a smaller scale." And I said, "You were very fortunate." And then he said, "Well, now, some of the people have been there a long time. When are they going to be masters?" And he used the term masters. And I said, "Well, just as soon as they're not touched by the world around them. Just as soon as they walk through the world and are master of themselves and do whatever they please and are not touched by the world around. But that doesn't mean that they ignore the world around them, but they're not touched by it. If they see something fall on the floor, they reach down, pick it up, and put it back. They don't say, 'You stupid person for dropping it on the floor.' You know, they just reach down, pick it up, and put it there. And that's what they do." And then he said, "Well, some of them have been with you a long time. When will they ever become a master like you are?" And I thought to myself, my goodness sakes, I never expected to hear that out of you. And, because he just doesn't know me that well. But he does read the gist, and what he asked, you see, it's not, as I say here, who you are, but what you are. We were in the archives, and he said, "Could I have a few of the German edition to give to my friend who speaks German, who likes this type of philosophy?" I said, "Sure." I said, "Now, what about this one?" He said, "Can I have the cause and effect, you know, the law of cause and effect? Can I have a couple of them? And can I have this here? Can I have that?" And he said, "And can I have some of these particular gists here?" And I said, "Sure." I said, "How about a tape?" Said, "Yeah, that'd be nice." So I gave him some of the tapes of our original course, you know, healing and meditation, and some of those that are fine. And so he said, "Wow, this is great." And he said, "I'm really going to enjoy this, and I am going to enjoy talking to my friend and having her read this and tell me what she thinks about it, you know." And he says, "I know what I can say. I know the author." You know, now, it wasn't that he flattered me. It's that in the subtle way that I have of sharing with him, and I wasn't too open with him. I just didn't go out and say, "Ba-da-da-da," you know, and have him say, "Oh, come on, get off it," you know. I just lived it in front of him and lived it with him. And that made all the difference in the world. And that's why we say here, it's not who you are, but what you are. How are you living what you believe? How are we living the things that we say we believe? "I live my philosophy." No, you don't. If you live your philosophy, you don't say a thing about it, just do it. If you say you live your philosophy, that means you're working on it. If you live your philosophy, you don't say anything to anybody about it. Not one little word about it. And the experience that we are having currently with our webmaster is a fascinating experience. Not because he's good or bad, but because we have allowed him to think that he knows more than we do about what we want to accomplish. And we've allowed him to think that he is our director of our program for us. And he is good. He is good. But in that relationship, he felt he should take over our whole operation. He should take over our bank account. He should take over all the things that we're doing and tell us how to do it. And we should not be at all unhappy with his overt action, you know. But we stood up just gently and said, "Hey, we've nothing against you, but we do not do that. We've nothing against you. This is not acceptable. If we're going to do something, we're going to do it. Not you, because this is our responsibility. This is our job. And as I talked to my cousin today, we were looking at the well house for the Oasis, and he says, "You certainly have a wonderful place here." I said, "Yes, we do." I said, "It belongs to the corporation, it belongs to God Unlimited University of Healing." He said, "Well, what would happen, who would take over if you weren't here?" And I said, "Well, Ellen would take over." And he said, "Well, what if you and Ellen both went?" I said, "Well, we have a lot of good people who are interested in it, and I'm sure they'd take it over. Mark would certainly oversee it because he knows that it's my baby and he wants to make sure that it's going to be running as smoothly as possible, giving it a little bit of his input, not too much, I'm sure." And he said, "Oh, well, if Mark has anything to do with it, then it will be all right." He said, "I just wanted to make sure that this wonderful organization that you've got going here and this wonderful teaching you have, that it wouldn't die when if you happen to leave."
Wow.
And, you know, I didn't say anything. You heard what I said, very little. I didn't give him a lecture and I didn't do anything. I just was gentle. And he picked up the stories of his attitudes and his ways, and it's really quite a blessing, quite something when you think how he is touching other people's lives now and how he is touching his son, Roy. And I know that Roy liked us before, but he didn't know why, or he didn't know what was going on. He just felt good, but something was wrong. And the thing that was wrong about his feeling good is it was his dad's idea. It wasn't his. And now he's coming to his own conclusion. In fact, he chose to sit in the front seat with me each time. And he chose to be aware and near and so forth. And you see, when you live what you believe, when you follow in your very heart, in your very soul, that which you believe, and you don't try to preach it, you don't try to tell other people how they should take what you're teaching them and run with it and make their life different, but you just are a living example, then everyone who looks at you is going to say, maybe there's something to that. It may just work for me. It might just work for me. Yeah. It might just work. And like our friend Michael, he says, and Herb says to me, "You're whole and perfect." There was no medicine for his unhappiness. There was no aspirins. There was nothing he could get. He had no ability to get any help. And so he had to say, "I'm whole and perfect." Poor guy. He said, "That's too easy, though." I said, "Yeah, that is. It is too easy. And that's why people don't do it." And he did it, and it worked. And did that make him a believer more than anything in the world? For him to do it for himself? I tell you, when we can speak our word for ourselves, when we can put the cause in motion for ourselves, when we can see it at work for ourselves, not that we're proud, "Oh boy, I said I'm home perfect. No, just I spoke my word, I'm home perfect, and it works. Just, it works. Matter of fact. Beautiful. And when you do that, wow. The door is open for you. Because it's not who you are, but what you are. Now, look at yourself. Look at yourself. What do your cousins think of you? What do your children think of you? What do your brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers think of you? Do they think that you're quite a special person? And I don't mean you're quite a special person because you're their kid, you know, or their relative. But do they think you're quite a special person because of who you really are? Do my sisters admire me because of what I pretend to be or what I really am? And like he said, I'm not going to tell you what your sister said. I know, but it doesn't matter. He was just sort of dusting me a little bit there. But that's okay. I know. It's not what you are, but who you are. Oh, no, I mean, it's not who you are, but it's what you are. It's what you are. Remember, it's what you are now. Playing in the abstract playpen. So many people enjoy playing in the abstract playpen. They think that talking about the abstract, talking about the abstruse, talking about the difficult to understand concepts is always so much fun and so rewarding and so thrilling. And when they get done, they haven't any more opinion they had when they started. The difficulty about working with abstract things is that you have no foundation to begin with. You are taking a point of view apart from the object itself. You're not looking at the object, you're not looking at its purpose, you're not looking at its direction. You're looking at it as an abstract concept, like, what is the moon? The moon is an abstract concept. It is a piece of planet spinning around out there so far from the Earth, reflecting the sun and doing things like that. Now, so what? It's just there. It doesn't mean a thing. It has no purpose. It has no direction. It has no reality to it. And then again, when we stop being abstract and we start being concrete, we say the Earth is a globe, and the Earth rotates around the sun, and the Earth rotates around itself, and the Earth has a moon, and the moon causes the tidal movements on the Earth. It causes the Earth to get fat and get thin and get fat and get thin along with the sun itself. And this is why the highest mountain in the world isn't the highest mountain in the world, because when taken from the center of the Earth, it's not the highest point. Because the Earth does get fat and skinny and twist and turn, and we don't realize this. Now that's a concrete concept. But an abstract concept would say, why does the Earth get fat and thin? I mean, I realize that the moon has something to do with it, the gravity has something to do with it, and the sun has something to do with it, all dealing with how the Earth operates, but why? Why is it created? Well, then you get down to another point, and you say, in my infinite wisdom and awareness, I created the Earth. But I created the Earth to have a certain type of people on it. And these people needed the moon to give it certain gravitational pulls against it and for it. These people needed to be so far from the sun so that they could live in this type of an atmosphere. These people needed this, and so therefore it was no mere accident that I created the Earth and I created the moon as it is. I did it with a purpose. I did it with a very concrete idea, knowing that I was going to have these type of people living in this type of a universe, in this type of world. The people that I have living on Mars and Jupiter and the other planets around this given sun here are a little different. They respond to different calls. They still have the one mind, but their bodies are different. And they're drawn to their bodies and to act upon their bodies for different purposes than the people on Earth do. The people on Earth are attracted to their bodies because their bodies are physical entities that are warm or cold or happy or unhappy and need food or don't need food or whatever the people on Earth choose to think about themselves. And the moment you start going into abstraction about it, then you become unbeneficial to yourself, because you are not considering what the real facts are. You can go into abstraction and say, in the great cauldron of the sky and the movement of the stars and the planets and the various moons and things like that. There's all a purpose. There's all a great purpose. But the purpose is immaterial. Because just the only thing that's material is saying, what if I were to move this star or move this planet or do these things? Well, if you were in your original purity and integrity and you said something like that, you can do it. But because you have come a long way from your inner understanding and now you are creatures of fact, that's all you are, is creatures of fact. The moment you start fooling around with the abstract, the moment you start fooling around with absolute or concepts that allow no changes in them, then you are not a good human being. A good human being is one who responds to his human environment and makes the best of it, utilizes it in a harmonious way. A good human being does not fool around with divinity. A good human being does not fool around with wishing for things. He just is a stoic, taking things as they come. That's a good human being. And that's what you all want to be. You all want to be good human beings who are limited by whatever environment you're in, who are limited by whatever mental conditions you live under, and so forth. So this is what you want to be. He says, no, I want to be divine. Well, you don't have the capacity to be divine. To be divine means you let go of the relative and you take hold of absolute. You let go of all of the conditioning that is subject to your creation. You follow that? Let go of all the conditioning subject to your creation and reach out into the beyond. Where did the idea come from of having the idea of having a creation? Where did it first come from? Where did the first atom come from? Oh, scientists have such a good time with that. They think the Big Bang Theory was when one atom burst upon itself. But why would one atom burst upon itself at just that point of 15 billion years ago? Why? Doesn't make sense. It has no logic to it. Because it's like saying the story of the Bible. Adam and Eve were running around on earth, and God created Adam and Eve. And then Adam and Eve had sex, and they had sons. And then the sons were messing up, and one son killed the other, and Adam and Eve says, out. And so he kicked them out of the family. And so Adam and Eve were the only people on earth, and their sons were the only other people on earth, and they went to another village and got married. Now, charming. You see, in your human logic, this doesn't make sense. In your human thinking, it doesn't make sense. In your abstracting thinking, it could be, because why not? So you are God, and you created this Adam and Eve thing, and you created it, but you forgot. Of course, God doesn't forget, but you forgot, and you said there were no other human beings on the face of the earth. In other words, there were no other creators who created people. But obviously there were. Obviously there were other gods creating people. Other gods? I thought there's only one God. Well, that's true, there is. You and me and you and you and you and you, we're all God. And we're all of God, which is a tough thing. And you say, well, how does that work on the relative? It doesn't. It only works in the absolute. And it only works in absolute when you don't relate it to relative. Because the minute you relate that to relative, it's illogical, unreasonable. Doesn't make any sense. So, we're playing in the playground of the absolute, the play box. Playpen of the absolute, and we are really just like our little puppy here, laying on your back with your toy and just having a great old time. You don't care where the toy comes from. You don't care what anybody else is doing around you. If you see somebody coming close, and you go and say, "Hey, maybe we can have an adventure together." And it's wonderful. And I think, as I was thinking this morning, Button comes up and paws me occasionally, he wants to be petted. I don't pet him enough. I don't really pet him enough. And last night, about 1 o'clock, he went out to tell somebody that they shouldn't be coming around our property. And he barked, and he barked, and he barked, and he barked, and he barked. So I went to the door and I said, come on. He came in, soaking wet, cold. What could I do? I had to put him under the blanket, you know. So he got all warmed up, but of course he took half the bed. And Love took the other half, so there I was. But logic would say to you, close the doors, close the doggy doors at night so they don't go out. And then they won't disturb you, except they'll be growling at the windows. And don't create them growling at the windows. Create them happy and content. Create them in a perfect harmonious situation. Why did I go outside to call Button in? Because he became quiet. He stopped barking. And I had to go out and see what he was doing. When the kids become quiet, then you have to check on them. When your thoughts are no longer on the relative, then you better check on them. As you may be thinking in an area that's quite different from what you think you're thinking in. You may be thinking on some pretty high-level stuff and not relative at all. And if anybody found out what you were doing, they would be very unhappy with you. Because you're not supposed to think dream thoughts. You're not supposed to think thoughts that are far out and magical. You're supposed to be right down to earth with everything that you do. But in the art and science of wholeness, we teach that God is neither
logical nor reasonable.
Not logical or reasonable. Why? Because it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be logical or reasonable. If you took two chemical compounds and put them together, you would think that a certain thing was going to happen. But if it wasn't to happen, it wouldn't happen. If you put two things together and you were sort of like an innocent child, it wouldn't blow up. If you were a knowledgeable adult or an older person and you knew that what those two chemicals did put together, making nitroglycerin or, you know, dynamite or whatever you make, you wouldn't be forgiven. You'd be blown up. But little kids are forgiven. Now, why are little kids forgiven? Because they don't have the intention of having those things happen. Adults have the intention of having it. Adults have the logic in there. Children have the no logic. They have the no responsibility thing. And it works like that for them. You've seen that happen. This is why we want to train ourselves to go back to that attitude, back to that opinion, back to that ability to work from that point of view. The abstract is only going to make you very unhappy. It'll make you unhappy because you are trying to understand the abstract with your relative mental attitudes, with your logical, conditional thinking, and it won't work. It won't work. Because you cannot... Well, I was reading in the Theosophical magazine the other day, this writer was saying, there are so many people who have achieved bliss, who have risen to high levels of spiritual consciousness. Many of the Indian gurus, many of the Indian fakers, people who are working on it very seriously, have achieved a very high level of spiritual consciousness. But none of them has the ability to tell what they experienced. There are no words that describe what they went through and what they feel. And because there are no words, it doesn't seem logical that there be no words. Because certainly, we have all these words. We can have something to describe this blissful feeling, but you can't. And each person experiences it differently too. So when we are playing in the playpen of the abstract, we're just asking ourselves to be a dilettante or nothing. We are not really taking a serious point of view at what it is that makes up our life. So until you're ready to absolutely let go and go into that higher level of consciousness, let the playpen of the abstract stand by itself. And you just play in absolute. Can you handle that?
Yes.
It'd be fun, wouldn't it?
Yep.
Okay.
I would like to
giving leash. Jein. Bitte. Giving leash. A mother recently said that she was talking with a family counselor, and the family counselor said that she should give her son more leash, give him more opportunities to step out on his own and to be himself. And the mother is recently sending the boy to seminars in the United States from their native home in Switzerland and Germany and wherever they're living, and they do quite nicely. The boy has an argument with the mother now and then, and the mother has an argument with the boy now and then, but I mean, that has to stop. That is totally unrighteous. Mothers never argue with their sons, and sons never argue with their mothers. Sons never want to say what their points of view are, and mothers never encourage the son to listen to their point of view. You understand that? Mm-hmm. That's part of the game of life. They just don't do that. So, the counselor said she should give more leash to the son. Now, what did the counselor mean when he said, give more leash to the son? I can only take my own instinctive, intuitive understanding of it, but I would think, in other words, don't let the son and his desires destroy you or shake you up too much. Just let him go do it. Let him go. Let him go and be himself. I find this very unacceptable. I have been aware of so many homes where the children are crying for attention. They want attention however they get it. When their father comes home from work and doesn't have time to talk to them, they jump up and down and they scream and they holler and they roll on the floor and they do everything to get attention, and everybody knows what they're doing. But they don't give them the attention. Now, it's not giving them attention in, so to speak, recognizing their miscreants, you know, miscreants. You don't do that. You recognize their need for attention, their need for love. And so, as we tell the story, the little boy comes into the house and says, Mother, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Remember that one? And so the mother says, she's ready to kill the kid. You know, what do you mean, hate me? But she doesn't do that. She's a mother. She's been through this. She knows the ropes. So she says to her child, well, Johnny, what seems to be the problem? And Johnny says, I hate you. Yeah, I know. But now, what seems to be the problem? Well, Johnny's mad at me, and he took my toys, and he went home. He took your toys and went home, and he's mad at you? Why is he mad at you? Well, we had a fight. Well, who won? I did. Well, no wonder he's mad at you. You got to let your friends win once in a while, you know. But you don't need to fight. You don't need to fight to prove anything. You just tell Johnny how much you think he is, what a wonderful fellow you think he is, and how much you like him. And you'll be surprised how Johnny will become your best friend. That's not because you're lying, because you do like him. Now, let's just go over and talk to Johnny. So they go over and talk to Johnny, and Johnny says, and then the little boy says, well, Johnny, Jimmy, or whatever his names are, I think you're wonderful. Mom told me that I should look for all your good points, and I couldn't find any bad points. So that's all I could see was the good points. I think you're wonderful. Let's go play. And the other kid says, what the hell, why not? You know. So they march out the house and play, and the mother said, well, another dilemma solved. But she could have said, you know, you terrible little child saying that to me. Well, when children are told that they should have more leash. All that the child is saying, I want some attention. Now, I think we are alert enough and intelligent enough and brilliant enough to recognize that, right? Don't shake your head, yes. Each one of us should be brilliant enough. What is it that this young fellow wanted his mother to let him do? Anyone know? To wash the windows. Remember? He wanted his mother to let him wash the windows in their employment place, that where she ran a studio. And apparently, he's 13, isn't he? Apparently, this 13-year-old boy hadn't had an opportunity to do that. His mother had it done, and she says, oh, no, no, I don't have time for you. You'll mess it up. You'll make the windows look worse after you're done than when you start. Isn't that the way it works? Isn't that the way it works? Have you ever seen the way kids wash dishes? Yuck! And the way they wash the floor or scrub the windows or stuff? Man, it's terrible. But they got to learn. And with a mother's gentle teaching, they learn. Well, this kid wanted to wash the windows. He wanted to do anything. So what did I tell his mother to do? Or at least what I told him to do?
Make him a partner in her business.
I said she should make him a partner in the business. And so he went to his mother and said that. Mom, I'd like to be a partner in your business. And she says, that day will come, but not now. She is crazy. If she would let him be a partner in the business, she's still in total control. What would that do to his ego? What would that do to his attitude about, this is my business. This is my work. I want to keep these floors swept nice. I want to keep this place looking ship-shaped. I want to do my best. I'm going to run home from school after school. I'm going to get good grades in school so that I'll be ready to run this business. Because Mother says, you got to take care of the books, too. You know, you got to add up the money that people are paying us. You got to know where it goes and how to do it. And the whole attitude of life becomes exciting, not when you give leash, but when you pull it in. When I take my dogs for a walk and I give them leash, they're pulling against their neck. And when I say heel and I hold them close to me and I let the leash droop a little bit, they walk right next to me. But when I give them leash, they pull and they have no order, no control, no general attitude that's going to be beneficial to them. Now, children are the same way, and adults are the same way. A man retires from a job that he's had all of his life. He comes home and says to his wife, well, sweetheart, what do you got around the house I can do? Oh, nothing. You just sit and watch TV. Well, how soon are you going to plan on having the burial? When you take away all motivation for life, when you take away all direction and all the importance, dear, I am so glad you retired and you're home now. I have a million things I'd like you to do. Now, you want me to tell it to you all at once or just one at a time? One at a time is just fine. One at a time is just fine. And then let me do it. Then give me the next one. I'll do it one at a time. Don't give me a lot because it makes it seem like I'm going back to work to get away from all of this terrible pressure here. But women who have intelligence and their husbands retire make sure their husbands are busy at something. If it's golf or tennis, if it is helping other people start new businesses, if it is using their expertise in whatever they feel they have to help somebody. And sometimes it's using the expertise that they hadn't used on their business and would have loved to done it. And they can go off to some other area. You got to not give leash, but you have to give direction. Now, women say, well, I don't know how to give my husband direction on his retirement. You know how to do it for a child. You know how to keep a child busy. You know how to make work for a child, things that don't have to be done, like have them wash your windows that you just washed and they look beautiful, but have them do it anyhow. And when they're done, say, wow, you got quite a talent for washing windows. Not too good at it, you don't say that, but you got quite a talent. And the kids say, yep, you take all the neighbor kids over. See, I washed those windows. And then the next day, the mother will say, hey, sweetheart, My front porch has been so dirty, with the wind blowing and so forth. Do you think that you could get every leaf and piece of dirt out of every little corner? Now, I know it's not easy. I know it's going to take a lot of intelligence and a big job to do this. In fact, you might invite your buddies to come over and help you on them. But it's going to take a lot of intelligence to do it. And then the kid comes in the house and says, Mom, it's all done. 3 minutes later, and the mother says, Oh, come on now, you can't have done that. And these three, come take a look, Mom. Mom goes out there. What did he do?
Blower.
He took the hose and he washed it off. Whoosh! All the dirt was gone. Everything was gone. It's spick and span and clean as a whistle. And he took the broom and scrubbed it over little areas where the dirt stuck a little bit. And Mom says, You got it. You're a fantastic kid. You're a wonderful brain. And this is true. Now, do you think that kid is going to like to help his mother do things? Oh, my, yes. Do you think the husband who has chores given to him by his wife is going to live a long, happy life? The wife's going to say, Well, Arnold, I've always wanted to have a bench out on the front porch. A nice bench that's built right into the front porch where we can sit down or we can take our shoes off or we can put our boots, you know. But, you know, I'd like to have it a bench like they have over in Switzerland. You know, with curlicues on it and twists and turns on it, you know, make it look really nice. And then paint it, the bench, bright colors. So it's totally contrary to our very sedate house. It's as though it's something out of Disneyland that happened to land on our front porch. And so he says, I don't know, dear. I think the neighbors would laugh at me if I do something like that. What do you care? What do you care if the neighbors laugh? Do you know what they're going to do? The wives are going to say to their husbands, Sweetheart, look what Arnold's doing over here. Can't you do something like that too? But you know what Arnold's going to do? He is going to take fun in doing that. And pretty soon he'll put a bench on the back porch. And then he'll put one behind the garage. So he can go out there and have a beer with the boys behind the garage when he feels like it and relax and maybe throw horseshoes. And maybe build up a little horseshoe pit back there. But make the home into a place where he is enjoying himself. They don't have to run off to all the far ports of the world. Travel is not the answer to retirement. The answer to retirement is having a happy heart and having something that you're proud of doing something for your home. Doing something that makes your life rich and full and beautiful. Now, if that's giving leash, that's a good leash. But that's not giving leash. That's giving motivation. When we can motivate our children to be fulfilled in every way, when we can motivate our dog to walk on the leash, then the dog can walk without the leash. But the dog cannot walk without the leash until the dog learns to walk on the leash. This is very important. And this is very important for us too. You were not allowed to go walking outside of your house when you were a little toddler without being in your playpen or somewhere secure so your mother wouldn't be worried that you walk off into the street or something. But you learned. And then when you were able to walk, mother would always walk with you to the edge of the street. She'd say, Now see all the big cars out there? That's their playground. Now you stay here on your playground. And pretty soon the neighbor kid said, Come on, let's run across the street. And, Oh, no, that's where the big cars play. We'll play over here. What? Yeah. See all the big cars playing out there? That's where my daddy and mommy and all the big people play. And they won't even see us if we come running out there. So let's play on the yard here. And the other kids will say, Huh, hadn't thought of that. Well, that's right. Well, then they go home and tell their parents, Do you know, Janie can't go playing out in the street because that's where the big cars play. And we're supposed to play just in her yard or our own yard. And the mother says, Thank goodness. How do they learn these things? They learn because somebody cares. Somebody kept the leash on long enough until they got the message. When you see in these movies these little kids who have these dogs that walk by their side and walk right at their heel, and they think a thought and they say, Rex, come. And Rex comes bounding across the field. Well, that's not the way it works. It can be. But it takes a lot of diligence to train a dog to do that. And dogs don't do that right off. They only do that when they're on the leash a long time and their master walks back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then he takes the leash off and he walks back and forth. And he has a little chain hanging on their chest so that they think they got the leash on there. And he walks back and forth and back and forth. And back. Pretty soon he takes that off and they walk back and forth. And he says, sit, come, go. The dog's purpose in life is to fulfill the requests of his master. The dog's purpose in life is to fulfill the requests of his master. That's his leash. That's his love. The dog is the happiest when he is fulfilling the desires of his master. This is true. A man's purpose in life is to fulfill the desires of his wife and his family and his world. That's what he has created. What do they say? God, mother, and country, or something like that? And apple pie? See, all these things, that's the tradition. So when you have something that you're under a leash of training under, and you do not rebel at it, but you get the greatest blessing it has to give, wow, you will live in this body a long, long time. I love you. First time on campus. It's kind of hard to talk about a person's first time on campus, because every time somebody comes to campus, they say, oh, I feel right at home here. Oh, this is so quiet. It's so lovely. I could be here forever. Everyone is so nice. Everyone is so considerate and so loving and so gentle. Everyone is doing their own thing. And it's so wonderful. So wonderful to be on campus, everyone says. Now, having said this, I have now used up 30 seconds. And what else is there more to say about the first time of being on campus? Well, the first time of being on campus, as with being anywhere, is to intelligently and lovingly figure out what are the rules. Not to say, this is how I do things, but what are the rules of the campus? Now, the rules of the campus are not there for the convenience of the campus. It might seem that they are, but they're not. If they were there for the convenience of the campus, they'd be quite different and far less prohibitive. But because they're there for the individuals who are there, because they're there for people who have come 100% to follow their spiritual path, it's not a matter they want to gain weight or lose weight, they want to get a tan, they want to use the swimming pool or the swimmix and things. It's not that they want to walk the path and they want to meditate, but it's that they really intensively want to go within themselves and find out just who they are. And this is what being on campus does. We go within ourselves to find out who we are. And the first time on campus, you can't believe it. You can't believe that all these people are taking the guff that they take, doing the things that they're doing, because it seems, well, unrighteous. It seems unfair to have to do all these things, because you're going away for a holiday. You're going to a hotel. You want to be served. You don't want to have to get up when it's time to get up. You don't want to have to go to a meditation. You don't want to have to go to these things. This is what most people think first off, that they're at a holiday house, and they'll be waited on hand and foot, and they are. When we serve at the table, it's like a fancy restaurant. When we say, does anyone have any laundry to do? Someone's doing it for you. But we're not doing it for you because we want to do it for you.
We're doing it for you because we don't want everyone doing the laundry. We want only those people who are in charge of the laundry to do it. And it may be different people, different days, but everyone has responsibilities and opportunities. Well, another very difficult thing when you come to campus is to mind your own business. Not to pay attention to what anyone else is doing. And that perhaps is the most difficult of all, because we're always interested in being our brother's keeper. Our noses, and I can see why they call an elephant's nose proboscis. Our noses are so long, we have them turned around the corner. We listen to what other people are saying. We listen to their meditation. We listen to their prayer. We listen to their affirmations. We say, oh, they're working on that. Well, that's interesting, you know. And that's none of our business. If a person says, I am independently wealthy, that doesn't mean that person's poor. That doesn't mean that person wants to be independently wealthy. That's just an affirmation of recognition that the person is independently wealthy, that it already is a condition of their life. If they say, I'm whole and perfect, it's not because they're suffering from some incurable disease or they have some problem in their body that they're wanting to take care of. They are just doing maintenance work. You understand that? Prayer and affirmation is maintenance work. Why do I say it's maintenance work? Because our true self, our reality, is what we are affirming. Our true self, our reality, is what we are praying about, what we're treating about, what we're knowing. We're not knowing something we wish to be there. We are knowing something that is there. Now, this awareness can come to those who have their first time on campus and not. It depends. It depends on what you do. Are you coming here to walk your path, to learn your path, to listen within yourself, to hear what the divine in you has to say? Or are you coming here to be curious of how everyone else does it? How are they walking the path? How are they doing things? And not unkindly, but you're just so curious because they're such beautiful people. Because everywhere you look, everyone seems to be illumined. Everyone seems to be whole and perfect. Everyone seems to be just so happy. Because that's our nature. We are affirming this. We are living what we believe. And so when people come here, they say, gosh, I hope some of that rubs off on me. Well, it won't rub off on anybody because there's nothing to rub off. What it is to reveal from within each of us who and what we are. So if we recognize that there's nothing from the outside that can be added. There's no quietness and peace here. This is a noisy place. If you were to get out your earphone thing and listen to the birds out there, they'd be quacking and squacking away all the time. And the worms, my gosh, they make a lot of noise when they crawl around. And the bugs and everything else around here. And the dogs, in the distance, they howl. But you see, when you come here to listen within yourself. And the minute you begin to start listening within yourself, there is no outer world. As much as you may be in the world, there is no outer world because you're not of it. You are listening to your inner world. And listening to your inner world, you're listening to a peace, a presence, and a power that is so dynamic, so powerful, so uplifting, that you never want to leave. And you don't have to. Because what you have found is within yourself. And you never leave it. But you do leave it. You do leave your inner self when you concern yourself about what's going on around you. You concern yourself about the wars, or the happiness, or the fairs, or the fun things, or the unhappy things. Whatever you concern yourself with in the outer becomes your inner. Because where your thoughts are, that's where your life is. Where your attitude is, that's where your world is. You are whatever you think about. And can you understand how that's so? It's not something we're making up, not a pretty platitude that seems to be dancing around here, but it's a reality. Do you like yourself? Does a little baby like himself? My goodness, yes. Does a little baby know what's going on around him? He cares less. Does a little baby live in a paradise? He's fed, he's changed, he's just a wonderful thing. It's like in the womb. Except now he's out in a bigger room and looking around and saying to himself, hey, that's all pretty nice. You know, hey, it gets dark. Hey, it's daytime. Hey, it's fun time. Got to play with my toe. You know? Or here's something that I'm batting around up here. I wonder what that thing is. You know? I don't really care, but it's just something to do. You know, all we here right now on campus have to do, all we have to do, if we want to see an illumined being, we look at Snuggles. Yeah. Right away. You look at Snuggles. Snuggles is a baby. He's 9, 10 weeks old now. He lays on his back and plays with his toys. Then he comes and gets attention. He doesn't get attention. I'll go in another area and play. I'm not touched. We are touched. We think he's barking. He wants attention. He wants this. He doesn't want anything at all. He wants just to be himself. And he comes running up to us, and he sniffs us, and then he runs away, and he goes somewhere else. He doesn't want anything except to be himself. He doesn't want us to bug into his world. Oh, if we snuggle him, that's his intention. If we feed him, that's his intention. If we wipe up his dribble, that's his intention. If he learns to go outside and does his thing, that's his intention. But we are the ones who say, whoops, he missed. He didn't miss. He did what he wanted to do. We missed. We missed by having it in our consciousness. We created that little wonderful guy in our consciousness. We call him the name Snuggles, you know. We created him in our consciousness, and he is exactly what we want. He's a contented genius. And you and I and everyone who comes to campus here is a contented genius. Because we create a quiet place. We create peaceful paths to walk on. We create mountains to climb that are just physical mountains, not emotional mountains. And as we get to the top of the mountain, we stand and we want to throw our arms out and say, hello world! And below us is a valley filled with nothing but the sound of our voice and the imagination of our heart. Everyone who comes to campus the first time, they think, man, whoever is here is living in paradise. But you see, then they make the fatal mistake. They call home, and immediately they're back in that other world. They write a letter. They're back in the other. They don't write a letter. I'm having a great time. They write a letter. How's everything going? They're not interested in how's everything going, or else they would have stayed back there. They're interested in how's everything going here. And get to know that. When people come to campus for the first time, if just for a visit, if just to deliver UPS or FedEx or whoever comes up here, US Mail, they feel this. They feel this, and they feel an integrity here. They feel something that's so sacred, they cannot say anything but good about the place, because that's all they know. That's all they'll ever know. Because that's all that we are here, is good and very good. Every person. People come here after having been in prison, and they look at this place and said, whew, how wonderful. People come from their families who are hectic and completely driving them up the wall, and they say, oh, this is wonderful. Now, can they have the same thing at home? Oh, yes. Because they're taking the self that enjoyed it here, wherever they go. Whenever you go someplace, the biggest thing to remember and the hardest thing to remember is keep your nose out of anybody else's business. When I take Snuggles with me wherever I go, he is always Snuggles. He is always at peace. He is always happy. He didn't say, I want to go home, I want to go home. Home is where he is. Home is where his body is. Home is where his life is. There is no other home. He doesn't miss me when I'm gone. He loves me when I'm there. Mm-hmm. And when I'm gone, he's doing his own thing. We say he misses us. We are the silly ones. So, what happens on your first time on campus? You begin to see the inner true you for the first time. And you like it. And you want to have more of it. And you show the sincerity of what walking the spiritual path means to you. How long you stay your first time on campus. You take it wherever you go. I love you.
Play the game! Damn it. Play the game. Play the game. Play the game. What is my role here? My role is as a nice guy who just is sitting here with a gray beard at the front of the table and just old and decrepit and not really helpful to you on your spiritual path and all that good stuff. Because you no longer think it's necessary to play the game. You no longer think it's necessary to play the game when I ask you once, and when I ask you twice, you don't do it. When I ask you three times, and you still don't do it, I am as useless as a third tit on a cow, you know, or whatever you find a third tit on. But it's also frustrating to share with you and give you all these wonderful ideas and not have you do it. Now you're going to say, well, just one person did that. Well, no, I can go into many details on the rest of you, too. But we'll take our favorite person we pick on, Sylvia, here. Sylvia said, the three pieces of salami there are old, and I wish you would eat them because they keep coming up on the plate day after day after day, and they should be eaten before they go stale. And so, that's all right. I'll take them. I took one. I ate it. And I gave one to Ellen. She says, I want one. I want one. So I gave it to her. And I gave one to Sylvia. And I said, Sylvia, eat it. And Sylvia put it on her plate and says, stick it up your nose, Buster. I'm not interested in doing anything you tell me to do. And I thought, oh, dear. Sylvia, eat it. Sylvia, eat it. Sylvia, give it to me. Now, what is so all-fired important about eating a piece of meat that I tell you to eat? Is Sylvia a vegetarian that she doesn't eat meat? Am I going violating her rules? Is she on a diet? Yes, she's on a diet, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't eat now and then too. When I ask you to do things, there is meaning behind it. There is big meaning behind it.
Simple, big meaning! When I just say, do it, do it. Don't go making rationalizations about it. And if you fight it, you don't belong here. You don't belong here, my God. Because I should not have to get all hot and bothered about this stuff. And I'm really not hot and bothered, but anyhow, I pretend like I am. And I shouldn't get all hot and bothered about this stuff. And you do this to me quite often. And the rest of you do it from time to time, too. And I point it out to you. I point it out to you so well.
we have our webmaster. And I said to the webmaster, I said, Daniel, I have nothing to do with the business of the web. That's all Ellen's work. All I do is create the material that goes on it. Well, Herb, this material should go on. We can do it like this here, and we can do it like that. I said, whatever you and Ellen decide is fine with me. And then Daniel writes the letter, and on the letter he says, Dr. Herbert Byerly. And Dr. Herbert Byerly, not even mentioning Ellen. Dr. Herbert Byerly, this is what it's going to cost. This is what our investment is. This is what our program is. These are the business details. And I said, Daniel, you deal with Ellen on that, not me. And so then a revised letter comes back. Dr. Herbert Byerly. He hadn't heard at all. And so then I go down there, and I talk with him, and Ellen is there, and Jeff is there too. And I say, Daniel, I am merely the one who performs. I'm the talking head. I'm just the turkey that goes out and gobble, gobble, gobbles. You guys put it together, whatever you want to do. And I tell you things I like to do, and you say, okay, that's fine. Ellen, are we going to do this here? Is this what we're going to do? You just don't go using me as your business head. And so this goes on and on and on. And then Ellen and I are down there talking with him, and I say, well, nice idea to get going on it. And he says, well, I want to do this. And Ellen says, well, I said, hey, anything you want. I said, it's a good idea. Go ahead, right now. Do the whole thing. Go ahead, you know. If you're not going to stand up and take responsibility for your task, whatever it may be, I'm going to say, go ahead. I say yes to everything, don't I? Have you noticed that? I say yes to everything. Anything you want to do. Yes, go ahead. But before I say yes, I usually say three times what is beneficial for you to do. Discuss it with Ellen. Discuss it with the abbot. Discuss it with whatever. I do not give the orders around here. I don't want to give the orders around here. I used to give the orders around here. When we started out, I gave all the orders and I carried them out too. I was the only one here. And then as other people came, I gave them orders, but I tried immediately to create executives. We had more executives than Indians most of the time. But that was the game too. And I said, carry it out. Do these things. Play the game. Play the game. If you don't play the game, you're not going to win. You're not going to have the fun of playing the game. And you're not going to win or lose. But play the game. Play the game. If I have to repeat myself so many times, the three times is more than enough, then you don't want to play the game. What you want to do is to have it your own goddamn way. Your own stinking way. You don't care. You don't care anything about the program here. If you care about the program, you'd take care of it. Now, I check all of the retreats regularly because I'm nosy. No, because I don't want them to burn down. Because you're all children. You forget and you put clothes on top. Ingeborg used to put clothes on top of the heater all the time, then walk out and leave it there. It's strange that they smoldered. They smoldered often, but they never burned, fortunately. But it could have, and whoosh, there goes our little retreat. Just because somebody didn't follow the orders, didn't play the game. And Sylvia, the abbot here, the wheel here, the great lady, she did the same thing, not once, but three times. And I mentioned it the third time to her. I go in there and I take things away. I don't say anything. And I take it away. I don't say anything. But the third time, I take it away and I say something. I say, hey, you left your stuff right next to the heater. Don't do that. And then, what are you doing touching my clothes next to the heater? How dare you go into my apartment, into my house, and monkey with my things? You know, that's the attitude. I can feel it. I don't have to hear you say it, but I can feel it. You know? And it's really something. It's really something. All of your retreats are open for inspection for our guests to come and look and see how monks live. They should all be as beautiful as you are. Some are, and some are not. Some of you make your bed. Some of you don't. Some of you, did you ever lift up Ingeborg's coverlet that she has in her bed? Well, don't, because it's not very nice under there. Not very orderly. And Sylvia, she left her pillow off the bed, down in the crack between it and over here on the side, and she left this here and that there. I could go on to a dozen different things. And each time I tell them, and then finally I said, Ellen, please, you go take care of these things, remember? I said, you go look in these apartments, you look in these houses. Every single time that there's nobody there. That doesn't mean many times a day, but at least once a day. And if everything's in order, super. Bless you, wonderful room. If everything's not in order, then go get the person, bring them back up there, and tell them this is not acceptable living habits, living patterns. And so, it's terrible. It's really terrible. When I say things to you so lovingly, so simple, and so caringly, and to have you tell me, stick it up my nose. But that's what you do.
Why are you telling me this?
You know, your righteous indignation is telling me to stick it up my nose. And I get righteous indignation not only from Sylvia, but from the rest of you too, including Ellen. And this is not acceptable. It's not playing the game. If you want the benefit of this game, you know, the coach, when the players don't play the game right, the coach says, no, I want you to go out and do this, and you go out and do this and this here. And when you don't go out and do it, the coach says, okay, we'll pull you out of the game. I'll put somebody else in. Okay, gives you another chance. He gives you chances. And then if you don't play, he says, you're off the team. Because the coach is not interested in babysitting his players. He is interested in training his players so they'll be exquisite. So they'll be a team that plays beautifully and harmoniously. Well, I am not training you to be a team. In fact, I'm training you just to be the opposite of a team. I'm training you to be divinely perfect, to be master of your habits, to be master of your self-discipline, so that you naturally just put your bed together in the morning. Were you in the service? In the service, we had to take our sheets and pull them around it. We had to take our blankets and pull it around it. We had to have it real tight so you could drop a coin on the top of the bed and it would bounce. Now, that's really not tough, but it seems tough when you're just beginning. A lot of guys didn't get it right away because they had never made a bed in their life. Their mommy always did it. But after a while, they learned how, and they did a good job. And it was quite beautiful, and they went home totally different people. But they learned how to have self-discipline. When the sergeant or lieutenant or anyone said, do this, there was no doubt about it. It was done. And I say to you, here we are in a monastery. Here we are in a school of the master. And when I say anything to you, do it. So forth. Now, I'm not going to give you directions on doing a job. That's not it. I'm talking about things here at the table, just little discipline things. Ellen gives the directions on the job, or Sylvia, depending upon what Sylvia chooses to do. But play the game, and you'll be very happy. I love you.